Today, explosions have killed hundreds of people across Sri Lanka. Michael Safi has been reporting from the ground. And Parliament was back in session as of yesterday. Jessica Elgott tells us how MPs are feeling about Brexit and Trump's visit. Just before we begin, this episode contains descriptions that you might find distressing. On Monday morning, South Asia correspondent Michael Safi landed in Sri Lanka, a country in shock after 8 explosions killed hundreds of people in churches and hotels on Easter Sunday. It was one of the worst terrorist attacks worldwide since 9/11.
One of the people who were among the first responders runs a small photography shop close to the church, and in fact, he's a wedding photographer.
My father said to come and take the photographs, but I couldn't. I saw the bodies. I can't remember my apertures and the shutter speed and ISO. I don't know how to keep. I said, I can't do this. I'm a wedding photographer, professional party photographer. I can't take these photographs.
Yesterday was a national day of mourning in the country, as the death toll continued to rise to over 320 people, at least 45 of them children. Islamic State say that they are responsible for the explosions. Sri Lanka has known terrible violence during a civil war that ended in 2009, but nothing like this.
In one day, 8 explosions, never did the war that we had, never had it happen like this. This in one day, so many lives in different places, in holy places, has never happened.
From The Guardian, I'm India Rakesan. Today in Focus, Sri Lanka's deadly terror attacks.
St. Sebastian's Church is this pink and terracotta red building in the middle of the town.
Michael Safi is The Guardian's South Asia correspondent.
It has a beautiful courtyard around it and gardens. And the first thing I noticed when we arrived was that the floor had yellow flowers all over it that had fallen from a tree in the courtyard. But then around the flowers, there was also shattered stained glass. And there were like patches of dried, something dried and red. We realized that this actually was people's blood. And there was shoes and water bottles and just debris and dust everywhere. It was a horrific scene, just horrific.
And St. Sebastian's was the second church to be hit in this string of bombings on Easter Sunday. What was happening in the church at the time?
So the mass was close to concluding. I was told by the priest who was actually leading the mass, and he said he was in the sanctuary, so he didn't actually see when a man arrived and started acting really erratically. He kept trying to push his way into the middle of the church, but people noticed that and thought it was really strange.
We were just about to conclude the mass,
yes.
And this guy came from that side. Within 2 seconds, he was in a hurry to come inside, and then turned this side and blasted.
He just heard a blast.
People were shouting at the top of their voice, crying, and some people with blood and some pieces of the body here and there, all that was there.
The mass that day was described by one of the priests at the site as the mass of the children. It was one in which children were emphasized. And so there were lots of children and their mothers all over the place, and they were among those caught right in the middle of this. The sense mainly was shock, because a lot of the people who had been there spent the next 2 or 3 hours removing bodies. There was one man who I met near St. Anthony's, and he told me he had spent most of yesterday carrying bodies out of the church, and at one point he broke down as we were talking, and all he could do was point to his eyes and to his nose and then to the sky, and he was silent for a minute, and then finally just said that the smell of blood is still on my body. This was a guy who has only started to comprehend the absolute horror that he's experienced.
And how many people died at this church?
Well, the estimate at that church is that about 110 people died and about 200 others were injured.
Michael, take us back to Sunday. Walk us through how the attacks unfolded.
Well, the first bomb is understood to have gone off at St. Anthony's Church at about 8:45 a.m. We know it was 8:45 a.m. because the church clock tower is frozen at that time, even now. So as soon as the bomb went off, the clock just stopped. There were subsequent explosions in a church in Batticaloa in the west of the country, and then in Negombo, which was just north of the airport near Colombo. And then as well as that, there were three explosions in some luxury hotels in Colombo as well. So, you know, very quickly it became clear that this was part of some sort of organized and coordinated operation.
Is there a sense of who was being targeted? At the time, was there a sense of who was being targeted?
Well, at first it appeared to be Christians. Obviously, the fact of churches being targeted meant that they were very much in the firing line. However, when the news emerged that luxury hotels were also being blown up, it became clearer that this was about sending a global message, that what was going on here was potentially more than just about social fault lines in Sri Lanka, and that whoever did this did it in such a way to cause a spectacle that might be, you know, easily comprehensible to people all around the world, you know, that they wanted this to be world news, to give people a sense that the targets were much wider than just Sri Lankan Christians.
And a number of foreigners were killed as well.
Sadly, two Australians have been killed as part of these terrorist attacks in Sri Lanka.
Yeah, sadly, we've been able to confirm that the number of British citizens who are among the dead has risen to eight.
And as you mentioned early on, we know that two Turkish citizens have also lost their lives in these attacks.
Nearly 300 dead, and there are several Americans among the dead, including a fifth grader.
All right, there's some terrible information coming in with regards to Indian casualty in the attacks that took place in Sri Lanka.
What do we know about them?
There could be up to 39 foreign nationals. And, you know, one of the things that has made this a difficult story to cover is that this kind of basic information is really unclear. You know, we're seeing a lot of discrepancies. There's a real sort of fog of war effect where, you know, a police spokesman will say something and then come back a little while later and say something a bit different.
And according to reports, police have arrested around 40 people now. What do we know about who's been arrested?
We were told they belonged to a terrorist group, a local terrorist group named the National Tawheed Jamaat, which is little known, certainly on the world stage and even in Sri Lanka. You know, this is a group whose previous exploits include vandalizing Buddhist statues, for example. I mean, these were thought to be small-time thugs here in Sri Lanka, but not really thought to pose a significant threat until, you know, suddenly they pop up and commit one of the worst terrorist attacks since September 11.
Is there any indication that they had help?
A minister has suggested that there was an international network at play here. However, sources I've spoken to say that all of the people arrested so far have been Sri Lankan nationals, and there hasn't been direct evidence of any kind of international cooperation.
We spoke to you earlier on the phone. Things quite quickly changed. You had to hang up. Can you tell me what happened?
Yeah, I was visiting the first church that was hit, St. Anthony's, which is actually in Colombo. And then around me, I heard people starting to scream and then run. And the scene descended into this, like, total panic. So I hung up and I spoke to some people about what was happening. And they said that there had been a suspicious package or a suspicious van. Something was going on. And you know, in these tight neighborhoods that surround the church, the rumors were spreading from apartment to apartment. And people were running out, holding their kids in nappies. They were crying and wailing. And after a few minutes, the police ran in brandishing their rifles. And they came out holding a young man in a green T-shirt. And they went to take him to a police car that was waiting. But then the mob that had formed caught sight of them and suddenly rushed them and started to attack this guy. And so you had the police surrounding this poor, terrified guy. We still don't know who he was or what they thought he did. We were told that it could have just been a misunderstanding because the guy is a Tamil. He belongs to a linguistic minority here in Sri Lanka. And so potentially he may have just been singled out and become the object of suspicion for that reason. And so things appeared to calm down, except about 5 or 10 minutes later, this giant explosion just rocked the street. Again, the screaming and wailing started and people started to run for their lives. We learned after 5 or 10 minutes of total chaos, bomb disposal squad had arrived at the scene and found a white van, which they suspect was the van that was used to actually transport the suicide bomber, and that they had gone to detonate it.
They said it's a bomb blasting, yeah.
And it blew up in a way that was apparently much larger than what the authorities had been planning, and so it caused this total panic and terror, and it underlined that Sri Lankan nerves are absolutely frayed. Police are finding pipe bombs, they're finding weapons caches. There's a sense that the horror that they witnessed on Sunday might actually not be over, that there might be more in store this week.
Michael, that must have been obviously terrifying for everyone around, but also very frightening for you.
Yeah, it was pretty confronting.
Clearly, tensions are really, really high in the country. And tell me a little bit about Sri Lanka. Tell me about the people who live there.
So Sri Lanka is, I guess, most well known for being an absolutely gorgeous place. It's like exuberantly green. It's got amazing beaches. It's very pleasant. But it's also quite a troubled place because for most of its modern history, it's been racked by conflict between its majority Sinhalese community and then minority groups, so minority Tamils, Muslims, Christians. I mean, it's a classic colonial story in that the British, who once ran this country, chose to favour a minority. And when they left, it left a kind of aggrieved majority. And so it's been with Sri Lanka almost from its inception. There was a kind of tension between the Sinhalese community and primarily the Tamils, who are the largest minority. And about 40 years ago, that tension spiraled into a larger civil war as Tamil groups started to advocate separatism, and some of them did so in quite a violent way. Most prominently among them were the Tamil Tigers.
And that's obviously a civil war in which over 100,000 people died over the span of, I think, the 26 years that it raged on for. When it came to a close, how was Sri Lanka left?
So the civil war came to an end 10 years ago in the most brutal fashion possible. The Sri Lankan army conducted a series of totally ruthless offences in which, according to UN estimates, 40,000 Tamil civilians were killed. And the UN has called for investigations into possible war crimes committed on both sides. So far, those investigations have actually been stalled by successive Sri Lankan governments who are much keener to simply put it to bed, but it remains unfinished business. And so these kinds of social fault lines are still very much alive.
You talked about that kind of fog and confusion in reporting after these events. There are some quite startling reports coming out that officials might have known about a possible threat to churches from this group up to 2 weeks before the attacks took place.
Yeah, that's right. The Sri Lankan Prime Minister and some of his allies have started criticising the Sri Lankan president, saying that there were credible warnings that were sent around about this attack, but they weren't shared consistently across the government. And I've managed to get a copy of a translation of the letter that was supposedly passed around. And it's incredibly specific. It names people. It names the group. It names their target. So it's unusual because these guys were certainly on the radar.
Well, what, I mean, why? How can there be a letter that exists like that, but no measures have been taken to prevent this horrendous tragedy?
Well, we can't yet say for sure, but what we can say is that the Sri Lankan government has not been operating at full capacity. The last time I was here was in October during a constitutional crisis in the country where, to put it simply, the president, Maithripala Sirisena, tried to illegally fire the Prime Minister, Ranil Wickremesinghe.
There's a political power play on in Sri Lanka. The President, Maithripala Sirisena, earlier telling diplomats that he'd moved up to next Monday, the date for Parliament to confirm his shock sacking of Prime Minister Ranil Wickremesinghe.
And Ranil managed to resist that effort and to restore himself to the Prime Minister's office, but not without, you know, brawls in Parliament and protests on the street. And since the constitutional crisis, they've essentially been running these parallel governments where they've divided up power, and the president runs certain ministries and certain institutions, and the prime minister runs his own, and the two barely talk to each other. And that may have contributed to what looks to be the total unreadiness of the Sri Lankan security establishment.
And after the attacks, Michael, there's obviously a huge amount of turmoil, a lot of panic, misinformation. Before Monday, there was this period where people were not even releasing the names of bombers. Everyone was afraid to name who might have done this. Why?
Well, I would say the main reason was that they wanted to confirm it themselves. I mean, this is, there are probably political machinations here that we can't even guess at. But the way it's been released anyway has been so unorthodox. I mean, to have the prime minister of a country, you know, release an intelligence report that was given to another part of the government. None of this reflects a kind of rational consideration of what the public needs to know. It's so far, it's just like tit for tat and people trying to make the political case against their political enemies.
Right. And there is also a curfew that people are under, and there's been a social media shutdown, which started on Sunday. So that's, I think, WhatsApp, Instagram, Facebook have all been banned. I mean, what's the reasoning behind closing all of those down?
Officially, the reasoning is that those platforms may facilitate misinformation, that their potential to spread rumour is too risky. Look, I don't necessarily buy that completely. I think Facebook is often used as a scapegoat by governments like this for kind of their own failings in you know, dealing with these like longer term social conflicts. But nonetheless, they clearly felt like Facebook was this dangerous new addition to the media ecosystem. And so they got out on the front foot and made sure to try to ban all of these platforms, though they're still accessible by VPN.
And what do the people that you've spoken to over the last 24 hours think of it? I mean, you know, it sounds like people are quite afraid. Tensions are high. People are worried about a backlash.
That's right. Most of the people I spoke with said that was a real concern for them now. In Colombo, I met a father and son. They were Sydney and Gratian Fernando. And Sydney told me that, you know, there may be a backlash here, but he doesn't want that to happen.
Because this church is a very famous church in Sri Lanka. A lot of people come around the country. It can be a Muslim, can be a Sinhalese, it can be a Hindu. They all come here.
Do you think if there's any chance that there may be a backlash against the Muslim community here in Sri Lanka after this?
There might be, but we, as Sri Lankans, we don't want that to happen. Yes. There might be, because earlier there were problems like this, like between the Buddhists and the Muslims, but we don't want that to happen because this is not to be blamed under any religion. It's a terrorist attack, not a religion attack. It's a terrorist that who has done this. It can be a Muslim, it can be anyone.
That's particularly true for many of the Christians I spoke to, because they are a minority and they understand that if the kind of tension at the heart of the country is let loose, you know, it might start targeting one particular minority, but it's probably not going to end there. Having said that, though, there was one priest who I met at St. Sebastian's this morning who wouldn't give me his name because he said that what he was going to say, you know, wasn't something that fit his, you know, priestly demeanor and what a priest is supposed to say. But he said that he couldn't understand why members of the country's Muslim community could want to do something like this. And he said that, you know, speaking as a priest, I'm going to be telling my parishioners that they need to love one another. But he said, I'll be honest, as a person, I'm angry. He was struggling with this very basic idea of his faith to kind of turn the other cheek when it seemed that all he felt was rage.
It's taken a long time for a lot of information to come out, come forward. How quickly do you think things are going to now move on and progress in Sri Lanka?
Well, one thing we all hope is that the divisions in the government that may have contributed to this attack will be put aside for now, that this tension between the country's president and prime minister will be at least temporarily forgotten. and that the whole of government will be united in trying to get to the bottom of this.
The government should take responsibility, because at the end of the day, it's their country, it's their government. They are the ones who are responsible for this. But anyway, what has happened now, so no point blaming anyone. But I would like if they could take more responsibility than what they did.
If that happens, we might start to see some results pretty quickly. That's what everyone hopes.
Michael, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
You can read all of Michael Safi and the rest of the team's reporting on the attacks at theguardian.com. Next, after a break of nearly 2 weeks, Parliament is back in session. So what's in store? Welcome back. As Parliament gathers after Easter recess, here's The Guardian's chief political correspondent, Jessica Elgott, with what's on the agenda. And Brexit and Trump are dominating discussions.
Parliament is back in session yesterday, meaning that the Brexit process begins again in earnest. What we've seen today is the resumption again of cross-party talks, although there was a bit of talks over the Easter break, but between Labour and the Conservative. And at the moment, that seems to be the key hope that Theresa May is pinning on getting her Brexit deal through. And that's quite bizarre, because there's not very many people around Westminster who think that these talks have much prospect of succeeding. So far, Labour say that she doesn't show much chance of shifting. The key things that they want is much closer alignment with the single market and for the UK to be in a customs union. What's more likely probably to happen over the coming days is that Theresa May will have to try and set out a new process for trying to find a parliamentary majority. And for that, they hope to get Labour support. But again, it's quite unclear whether Labour could agree to that either. What we understand from some of the briefings from Downing Street is that Theresa May is considering bringing back next week the withdrawal agreement bill, known as the WAB. And the bill is the thing that was supposed to be passed after MPs had ratified Theresa May's withdrawal deal. At the moment, the law says that there needs to be a vote in Parliament on the deal, but there might be a way for them to amend that legislation in order to make that the binding vote. So she could bring the withdrawal agreement bill to Parliament. And one advantage of doing that is that it gets around the Speaker's ruling, the Speaker's John Bercow's ruling, that you can't keep bringing the same thing back. This would absolutely be a different thing. This is a bill rather than a vote. But she could only bring that back once this Parliament, so she would only have one shot at this. The atmosphere in Westminster really feels like everyone is really, really entrenched in their positions now. As you know, I probably would have said 6 months ago that a lot of Labour MPs might have been open to backing a softer Brexit deal, not to the Prime Minister's deal, but one that was softer. But now people are really firmly entrenched in the position of a second referendum. The Brexiteers, who have not supported the PM's withdrawal agreement so far, it feels very, very, very unlikely that they'll ever do so in any circumstances now. I think for the majority of MPs, although it might have seemed completely crazy for them to go on an Easter break, most people working around Westminster could see that people were, you know, quite literally being driven mad by the process. I was told about one MP who, you know, had booked some sort of holiday with his family and broke down in tears at one point when he thought that there was the likelihood that Parliament was going to be extended over the Easter break, having previously cancelled such a holiday with his family. And some of them, you know, seriously just need a break to reconsider. Now, I think what Downing Street were probably hoping is that MPs would go away, calm down and think, we really want to avoid European and Parliament elections later in May. And our constituents are telling us that we just want to get Brexit done. So maybe we should just grit our teeth and get this over with. But the thing to remember is that they also thought that at Christmas, when Theresa May cancelled the first vote on her deal. And I mean, what they did is come back and vote against it in the largest majority ever against a government proposal. And the other thing that's looming on the horizon, one of the things that might be end up being the last acts of Theresa May's premiership, is a state visit from Donald Trump. something that's likely to have huge opposition from Parliament and in the country. We had mass demonstrations last time he was here, and that was just for a short working visit. I expect you would see then MPs from all parties joining the protests against him when he does come. And so that's another struggle that she's got on the horizon. And it is only 6 weeks away. It's an extraordinarily short amount of time to plan this visit. And so perhaps she'll be hoping that that will mean there's less time for his opponents to organise as well. But I suspect that they'll probably manage to do it in time.
That's all for today. My thanks to Jessica Elgott and to Michael Safi. Today's episode was produced by Mythili Rao and Leia Green. Sound design was by Axel Kakutier, and the executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.